MG is back, and it's electric. The MG ZS EV. From just €28,995, the truly affordable, family-friendly electric range. Go to mg.ie and recharge your soul.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to this special Christmas edition of the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. It is that time of year when we ask you, our listeners, to set the agenda for the show by sending in questions, which we try as hard as possible to answer as honestly as possible. At least that is the general idea. Let's see how it goes anyway. It hopefully won't come as a surprise to you to learn that we did record this podcast a few days before Christmas, so do bear that in mind if any issue we discuss has been overtaken by events. Although, interestingly, we received no questions at all directly about this year's pandemic. Anyway, before we do get going, I want to draw your attention to the Irish Times' upcoming Winter Nights Festival, which features a number of in-depth discussions between Irish Times journalists and significant public figures, everybody from Edna O'Brien to Dara O'Brien, and from Nicola Sturgeon to Micheál Martin. The festival is going to run online from January the 25th to the 29th, and tickets are €50 or €25 for Irish Times subscribers. So just go to irishtimes.com/winternights to find out more. Now, joining me today are Pat Leahy, Harry McGee, Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones. God rest ye all. Usually we would be in the Irish Times studio raising a glass of something and even nibbling on a mince pie if our producer Declan's budget stretched to it, but not this year. I haven't actually seen any of you in the flesh for 10 months now, I think. We're going to go straight to our first question. It comes from John Feeney and he asks for a rundown on the best performing rookie TDs. Going to throw this one to all of you, but first to you, Jen.
I knew you were going to come to me first on that. I was like, don't come to me first, I can't think of anybody. Rookie TDs, okay, let me think off the top of my head. TDs who I think perform well, despite, against the odds, despite what people said in the beginning, I think actually Norma Foley has kind of pulled it together a little bit. I think in the beginning she got a lot of flack because she was a first-time TD, first-time minister. She was going into a portfolio at a time when we had COVID restrictions coming in and all these questions around whether the schools would be open, whether they would reopen. And I think one of the big credits to the government this year has been that they got the schools open and that they kept the schools open. So I'm going to give that one to Norma Foley.
Okay. Harry McGee?
For me, I think Holly Cairns of the Social Democrats has been very impressive, as has Jennifer Carl McNeill of Fine Gael. I've been impressed by Claire Curran of Sinn Féin, Brian Ledden of the Greens. On the Fianna Fáil side, Paddy O'Sullivan, I think, has been very good. There have been a couple of senators who I think have been very good as new senators. Rebecca Moynihan of Labour and Maria Sherlock of Labour have both come along with some very good pieces of legislation. I also think that Mairead Farrell of Sinn Féin has been very impressive. She's from Galway West. And she has been the public expenditure spokesperson for the party and has done very well.
Okay, Jack.
I'd like to point out that Harry has named all of them. That's a little unfair on the rest of us.
He does tend to do that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say Jennifer Carl McNeill and Holly Cairns both have been good. You know who's been good, actually? Matt Carthy has not been bad. And it's kind of almost a little bit of a surprise to think of him as a first-time TD because he was knocking around in Europe for so long. But he's performed pretty well in the agriculture brief for Sinn Féin and has been an effective kind of thorn in the side for the government. He's a good, competent media performer, does well at committees and so on. So just partially by virtue of the fact that he's good and partially by virtue of the fact that Harry hasn't mentioned him, I'll go for Matt Carthy.
Okay. Pat, you're bringing up the rear here.
Yeah, I think the outstanding new TD is probably Holly Cairns. You know, she's in a small party. She's done really well to get noticed. All of her interventions have been pretty well judged. She's used social media very well. So I would say she's probably the outstanding of the new TTs. Also, I'd go along with Harry saying Mairead Farrell has really impressed me. Also, I've looked at her at a few committees where she's kind of Pierce Doherty's understudy, his public expenditure understudy to his finance brief. And she's been very impressive. And one other new TD On this occasion, though, he was previously a TD and lost his seat, is the independent Michael McNamara, who was formerly a Labour TD from Clare, who chaired the COVID committee, and I thought did a good job with that, and whose interventions in it all are generally pretty well judged.
So now I'm going to move on to a kind of a number of questions, and we have quite a few of what you might call inside baseball questions. And I think maybe that's not surprising given our listenership. They're interested in what goes on under the hood of politics and indeed of the coverage of politics. So we're going to take a few of those now. The first one comes from Connor Kelly.
Hello, my name is Connor Kelly. I'm a research assistant at UCL and a PhD student at Birkbeck College in London. I really love the podcast. I listen to it every week. And I'm just wondering, do the panel know if the podcast has much of an impact on the sort of Leinster House bubble? Has any famous fans, TDs, senators, or ministers ever said that they listen to the podcast? And do you know what influence it has on debate amongst politicians themselves?
Jennifer, what sort of feedback do you get from the other side of the fence?
Does it have an impact on the bubble? But I think the key word here is bubble, you know, because it is a bubble in Leinster House, and like we're in it a lot of the time, and it's important to remember that. Most of the feedback I get from politicians about the podcast is people giving out. Usually someone's annoyed that I've said something about something they said it differently or something like that. Or once I actually said what a Fianna Fáil politician had said in a parliamentary party meeting, they got in touch with me to say, yes, I said that, but I also said 10 other things. Maybe next time you're on the podcast, you could go through this list of 10 things, which obviously never happened and wouldn't happen. So no, honest to God, most of the reaction I get is just politicians griping at me about things that were said or like different analysis, but in a good natured way, to be fair. I don't really know how many politicians listen to the podcast, but I'd like to think plenty.
What do you think, Pat? Do people listen to the podcast, not just the politicians, but maybe their assistants as well?
I think it's amazingly influential, Hugh, principally due to the expert chairing of debates by yourself. Lots of people around Leinster House, around the bubble, listen to it. They often mention it to me. And actually, I suppose, broader point about changing media habits there. I think a lot of people who don't necessarily have the time to be reading every scrap of political coverage in the papers use the podcast as a way of catching up. And I suppose that's something we've talked about ourselves as a function of the podcast sometimes at the end of the week to do a catch up podcast. But to give a straight answer to what I assume is a straight question, yeah, I think lots of people around Leinster House listen to it. Would be rather worrying if they didn't, frankly.
Do you agree, Harry?
You get certain feedback. I mean, I don't know which ministers listen to it, but I do know that most advisors listen to it and listen to it very closely. And I think the fact that we have a big listenership in the general population as well suggests that it is very closely listened to within Leinster House. I must say, I haven't got all that much feedback in relation to the podcast, but that's not surprising. We don't really get all that much feedback unless we have made some transgression or kind of stepped over the bound. But we do get people from time to time who say that they follow it religiously. And I know of at least two senators that I can think of off the top of my head, plus a handful of TDs who tell you that they listen to it all the time. So, yes, I think it's closely listened to. I couldn't tell you how many, but I know that a lot do listen to it and follow it very closely and hopefully enjoy it as well.
I have another very interesting question here from possibly a thorny one as well. You never know. Let's see how it goes, from Padraig Stack. He asks the following. I wonder what political parties and organisations members of the panel have been involved with in the past. Is it a bit odd for people who are so keenly interested in the political process in Ireland not to have been involved in political organisations at any stage? So that's a two-part question, Pat. Go to you first.
Well, I've never been involved in a political party. I have friends, I think, in all of the parties, though I suppose most of my friends are probably in none of the parties. But I suppose the listener won't be surprised to hear that I, and I assume all of us, have been interested in politics for many, since I was a teenager, I suppose. I suppose there's a broader point, Hugh, about which we've touched on in these sort of sessions before, which is about the, you know, the political views of our journalists, because I'm sure that, you know, we all have views on issues and individual parties. And I think that that is something that we are aware of, and that we work hard to ensure that it doesn't influence our coverage, in that we strive to cover all the parties. Obviously, some are of greater interest to us than others because they are bigger and more important, or they're in government, or they might be in government. And but as to the general point, which I don't know, maybe covered in further questions about our own political views, I think that A, we're aware that they may colour our coverage, but we are conscious of not letting them do so.
And we probably will come to that, because there are a couple more questions along those lines. But Jennifer, were you ever in a political party?
No, never in a political party. Don't have any previous links to any political party. And actually, something that people probably don't know about me is that I generally shy away from voting in general elections, because I actually feel a bit uncomfortable about even going down the line of thinking about even my local politician, who I'd feel comfortable with. Like, I do vote in referendums, but generally I do steer away from it for that very reason. That's probably a bit lame of me, and I'm sure plenty of people think that's totally unnecessary, but that's how seriously I take that. And I'm not from a political family. My family were never really interested in politics. It's a mystery to them that I'm a political journalist. They don't understand why. They just look at me and think there's something wrong. But no links to politics. But I do think that an interesting point is raised, like Pat said, about our perceived affiliations or our perceived bias. And I think it's absolutely fair enough that journalists are asked, you know, is there a perceived bias? What I don't think is fair enough is the assumption that we're all kind of, if you write a series of negative articles about any party, whether it's Fine Gael, whether it's Sinn Féin or whatever, especially on social media, the presumption is just that you are, you know, like a government shill, or that you're hiding your implicit bias. I mean, the fact is, I don't think I'd vote for, I don't, but if I was told you to sit down now and vote for someone, I don't think I'd vote for any of them. So, yeah.
And I've seen you've had some direct experience of that, actually, over the last while. I just very briefly want to get through this thing about the parties. Harry, were you ever in a political party?
No, I've never been a member of a political party, even though I have been accused of being a member and fellow traveller of every conceivable political party, and also of being regularly of being an establishment stoogie. You know, and in a way, there's a bit of truth in that, because I think that you carry a little bit of every party with you. There are some times when you think that a particular party is doing particularly well and you might agree with its direction or its policies. And sometimes you take a dislike to something that another political party is doing. You tend to be a bit of a magpie in terms of taking a little piece from each of the party. And I think the observation I'd make in relation to that is you can't really ignore your own human prejudices and the way that they colour your view of the world. You have to be able to recognise those human weaknesses. I think it's impossible to completely eradicate them. So what you have to do is you have to try to be as objective and fair-minded and disinterested as you possibly can be, to try and get balance in, and if an assertion or a claim is made, and to give people a right of reply. So really to try and not infect your reporting with your own boring life and your own predictable prejudices. So that's the kind of the high bar to which I aspire, and one that I don't come very near all of the time.
Jack, ever in a party?
Never in a party, no, but my wife makes fun of me because my family are political and obsessively nerdishly so, to the point that when we were on long car journeys when we were kids, we used to have pop quizzes of cabinet ministers. that's how incredibly sad we were. So it'd be kind of, you know, driving to Cork or something like that. Who is the Minister for Foreign Affairs? Dick Spring! 1 point! But we were all losers, really. I think the points they've made were really good. I think that Harry's right that, you know, it's kind of it's really unrealistic to pretend that bias doesn't exist, even if you're not aware of it. It exists on a kind of cognitive level. So, you know, you have to make every effort to correct for that. And the best way to do that, to approach that, is through fair-mindedness, you know, and that has to be one of the poles of how you go about doing your job every day.
I'm taken aback to discover that I'm the only person who was ever a member of a political party. And that was a very, very long time ago in my teenage years, when I was briefly a member of the long defunct now Socialist Labour Party, led by Noel Brown and also for a while by Jim Cammy. But I've moved on in all kinds of different directions since.
I was afraid you were going to say that you were a member of Clan Republicta.
Yeah, I'm almost that old, Pat. But thanks for that. I want to go to another question. Now, this question's from Eta Kelly. And Jennifer, I'm not going to put this question to you at least first, for reasons which will now become obvious. Jack, why are there so few women reporting on politics across all platforms?
You know, we're gonna get terrible feedback for putting this to a man first. I think that first of all, I'm not entirely sure that that's true. There are quite a few female colleagues in the press gallery, and excellent colleagues at that. I think that the reasons why you might see female participation perhaps fade as time goes on aren't unique to politics. I think that, you know, as women kind of, you know, like, you know, enter into childbearing age and so on, workplaces in general, and that includes Leinster House and newspapers and radio stations and TV stations, are not well adapted to catering for that. And then I think on top of that, and this is something that affects men who have children as well, is that, you know, the working demands of covering politics are fairly intense. You know, it is not unusual to start extremely early and finish extremely late and be extremely busy in between all those hours that come. You know, so balancing that with a family life and family commitments is very difficult. And I do think that, you know, it would be you know, trite, or it would be unrealistic to say that there's not a fair degree of, you know, ingrained unconscious bias. We were talking about unconscious bias in terms of covering politics, but there is unconscious bias and unconscious sexism within politics, within all those institutions that I mentioned above, you know, so I think all those factors play into it as well.
Jennifer?
Well, recently I saw a picture of the Leinster House Press Gallery from a good while ago, and it was 95% men. There were some honourable, notable exceptions, female political journalists amongst them. And I do think that over the years that has changed. We do have more female journalists reporting on politics across all the platforms, whether it be in newspapers or whether it be on TV. I mean, from my own perspective, I started working in journalism 13 years ago, and over those years, I found the areas that people would prefer that I worked in different papers were areas like showbiz or education or health. And they were kind of areas that maybe previous editors felt that I fit more naturally into, and my female colleagues too. I always wanted to be a political journalist. I was just waiting for the opening to come up and for the opportunity. And I'm glad that happened. But when I joined Leinster House then, I did notice that my male colleagues were taken more seriously when they asked questions, whether that be about Brexit or whether that be about anything. But I saw it, and I saw times when I'd be putting in a call to maybe a minister or maybe an advisor and sit beside a male colleague, maybe from a different newspaper, who put in the same query and call, and they would hear back before I would. Maybe some of that was because I was newer, but I do think some of that was almost an unconscious bias on their part to take queries and questions from male journalists more seriously. You know, and I don't really know what the answer to that is. I definitely think some of the problem, tiny bit of the problem, I think, is definitely, like Jack said, the really unsociable hours. But I'm a female journalist. And in fairness, I don't have kids, but I covered just as well, I hope, as my male colleagues in other papers too. The stress, I mean, like the stress of the job. So I'm not so sure if that's the biggest thing. I think the biggest thing is it's almost like this was the way it was always done. It's a cultural thing. But I think it's changing, and I'm really glad that it is.
Pat, finally, you've been in a senior management position across more than one newspaper now. So, I mean, you're in a position on the other side of the desk, I suppose, the interview desk, for example, to have a perspective on this?
Yeah, I'd actually be interested in looking at what the gender breakdown is amongst the political correspondents in Leinster Houses at the moment. I mean, the guys can correct me on this, but I would say it's probably not far off 40% female, 30-40%. Anyway, I'm if I was a woman, maybe I'd be more aware of it. I do remember that when I started reporting from Leinster House for the Sunday Business Post, which was, I'm afraid, 18 years ago, that many of the most prominent political correspondents then, people like Geraldine Kennedy, Muail Muirtainen, Emily O'Reilly, Una Claffey, they were all women. So I think that women and very talented women political correspondents have always been part of the picture in Leinster House. The fact that they experienced sometimes very sexist treatment down there, I think will survive or surprise nobody and has been fairly well documented. I very much agree with what, you know, Jennifer and Jack say about the antisocial hours, which would put off not just women, but anyone in their right mind, frankly, because sometimes the hours, I'm not complaining. Nobody's forcing us to do it. And we are, after all, covering the politicians who probably work longer hours than we do. But yeah, I think the antisocial hours are probably a reason why women and other types of people tend to not stay in Leinster House for a very long time.
Okay, we're going to turn to the subject of the present government now. We have a few questions in on that. The first one is from Brian Flaherty.
Hi, this is Brian Flaherty from just outside Boston. As an American, I've been interested to see how Leo Varadkar seems to be a pretty active Taoiseach, very outspoken and I know he is part of the government, but he's also not the Taoiseach. And I'm curious, has there ever been a time in Irish history when the Taoiseach was from a different party than the Taoiseach and was so active politically?
Brian, thanks very much for that question. And it's really great to have listeners, you know, listening in from around the world. And hopefully we're educating you a bit about Irish politics. It is the case that there have been some very political Taoiseaches in the past. But this, Harry, is a particular sort of political Taoiseach that we haven't seen before.
That's true. He belongs to possibly the biggest second party in government, almost in the history of the state. I know Labour were big in 2011, but they were comparatively smaller in comparison to Fine Gael, which was almost twice its size. So I congratulate Brian in the first instance on his very good pronunciation of Taoiseach, and hopefully he will be able to get his tongue and mouth around words like Cán Chóirle and Cathaoirleach of the Seanad. But he makes a good point. I think what we're seeing is Leo Varadkar acting as a political leader. And I think he's trying to redefine the Taoiseach role as a leadership role, not so much as second in command, but first amongst equals, really, or second amongst equals, maybe trying to replicate the relationship that Michelle O'Neill and Arlene Foster have in the North, where there's deputy ministers, first minister and deputy first minister, but they have almost equal billing. In terms of the historical context, we have seen Taoiseachty from other parties in the past who have tried to assert themselves quite strongly. In more recent history, of course, has been the Labour Party in 2011, first Eamon Gilmore. We can never forget that amazing slogan, Gilmore for Taoiseach. And when Gilmore was Taoiseach, he did try to assert himself. I think Joan Burton, actually, when she carried the baton afterwards, tried to assert herself even more with mixed result. I think if you go back as well to the Progressive Democrats,
we see another example of that. And the one that comes to mind for me in particular was when Michael McDougall was tarnished in the run-up to the 2007 election. He tried really hard to assert himself and to make himself out as some kind of alternative leader in some instances to Bertie Ahern. But unfortunately, that experiment had a very unhappy ending, both for the PDs and Michael McDougall, in the sense that they went into the election with 8 seats and they merged with 2 seats. And Michael McDougall, unfortunately for him, lost his seat. But I think the observation is a good one. I think Leo Varadkar is defining the role of Taoiseach in a very different way than we've seen before. And of course, we have this notion of rotating Taoiseach as well. So there is a kind of a sense that he is minding his own party, that he's setting himself out as a real Taoiseach or as an alternative Taoiseach. And in the first few months, certainly, that experiment worked very well for him. I'm not sure if it will continue to work well in the future.
And on that very subject, Jack, we have another question in. It comes from Aidan O'Hare, and he writes, asks about a speculative what-if scenario for you to consider. How different would the last 6 months have been if Leo's turn at rotating Taoiseach had come first?
I think that a lot of the difficulties that Fianna Fáil have encountered in terms of polling might have accrued to Leo Varadkar and to Fine Gael. I think that inevitably he left on the crest of a wave. He left as we were opening up the economy after locking down COVID and people were seeing each other again and socialising again. And we had come through the first wave in not altogether terrible shape. And obviously, he and Fine Gael were incredibly buoyant in the polls after that. And the next phase was always going to be significantly more difficult, because even though we kind of hoped that we might be able to keep the foot on the throat of COVID, I think that realistically that was never actually going to happen. And the next administration, whoever led it, was always going to be making more difficult calls and more unpopular calls. And the kind of social and political consensus that had underpinned the first phase of the reaction to COVID was going to disintegrate a little bit. So I think that he would not be as popular now as he is if he had been Taoiseach. In terms of would things have been different, like from a policy point of view, I would imagine that, you know, he is more in the kind of laissez-faire mold and more kind of, you know, in favor of keeping stuff open. But ultimately, when it comes to the big policy moves, they have been kind of formed by consensus around the cabinet table and at the COVID subcommittee and other important government groups. So I don't think there would have been any kind of massive divergences or differences. I think that the main difference would be that, you know, he may not be as popular had he been in the hot seat. And I think that it's interesting as well, because, you know, the next couple of years are going to be very difficult. And the first crack of the whip is, I think, almost certainly going to have the more difficult share of the next of the two Taoiseach that are going to serve in the lifetime of this government. And by the time he comes back into the role, you know, COVID will hopefully be a distant memory. Brexit will hopefully be squared away, and the problems will not be as kind of fundamental. And you know, we may be even be experiencing, you know, some kind of I don't want to say economic boom, but certainly a kind of prolonged growth period as we come out of the current difficulties, and that will be wind in the sails of whoever is leading the country going into the next election, whenever that is.
And Pat, maybe in addressing that question, that you could also address this one related from Crawford Smith, who's a regular listener from Scotland. Crawford says this: you mentioned a couple of weeks ago in the podcast about how Fine Gael's poor performance at the election has never really been examined inside or outside the party. It's bounced back in the polls following the caretaker government's handling of the crisis, and with Fianna Fáil currently the face of the government. But given that bad election performance, the drama surrounding Leo Varadkar's leaking of information that was in the media, and suggestions that the rise in the polls may only be temporary, how secure would you say Leo Varadkar's leadership of Fine Gael actually is?
Oh, I'd say it's pretty secure for now, which is, I suppose, all one can ever say in politics. I don't see any threat to Leo Varadkar's leadership coming from a challenge from either another minister or from his backbenchers. And there is certainly no sense that the party is restive in the way that Micheál Martin's party is certainly restive. I mean, Micheál Martin has always been slightly apart from his parliamentary party. He's always been pushing his parliamentary party in directions that many of them were uncomfortable with. But it seems to me that in recent months, not just because of the sackings from or the resignations from cabinet, but because also of the many people who were extremely and vocally disappointed at not getting promoted to ministerial jobs upon the formation of the government, that Micheál Martin has an internal opposition within his own parliamentary party that is more vocal and more dangerous to him than anything previously. That having been said, I realise that the question was about Fine Gael and particularly about the leadership of Leo Varadkar. Whilst I think there is no danger of a challenge to Leo Varadkar, I think that some of his TDs have quietly questioned his judgment in recent months. I think on the question of the leaks, the leak controversy about the GP's document, about the appointment of Seamus Wolfe, which controversy, as Harry was reporting this morning, continues to fester. I think on one or two other things that there have been questions about Leo Varadkar's judgment, not about his leadership, but about his judgment that I haven't heard in the party before. And the background against which they are set is the knowledge in Fine Gael that the election campaign and the attempt to sell Varadkar to the voters last February didn't work at all. At all. It flopped. The Varadkar project, or the project to present Varadkar to the voters, flopped. And that hasn't been forgotten by many people in the party. It's been pushed to the background because the caretaker administration that ran from February to June was seen as handling the first phase very well. But people in Fine Gael haven't forgotten that the election campaign was a disaster, and a fair bit of the credit or blame for that, I think, will ultimately be laid at the door of the leader.
And just the last question on the two large government parties to you, Jen. At Irish Agreement on Twitter, I think this question might have come directly to you on Twitter. With the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil vote share dropping, will the party leaders ever push for a merger? Or will the Fine Gael leaders just wait for Fianna Fáil to just collapse? And if so, where will that Fianna Fáil membership go?
Yeah, I saw that question. It's a really interesting question. And the answer is, I actually don't know. I'd be lying if I said I did. I think that if you look at where we were at the start of the year before the election, and the really strong protestations, that, you know, the protests that TDs and both parties made, that they would never, ever go into a coalition government with the other. And, you know, I remember sitting at one of the Fianna Fáil press conferences and asking Jim O'Callaghan and Dara O'Brien, I think it was, you know, is there really no circumstance at all, notwithstanding whatever happens, that you will not go into a coalition agreement with Fine Gael? And they both said, no, absolutely not. Now, of course, they're the promises that are made during a general election campaign. And a lot of us know that it's not always necessarily, in fact, often not what happens afterwards. The point I'm trying to make is that even if you think to yourself, you just could not imagine this happening, it probably could happen. And I think the parties are closer in ideology to each other than they like to admit. And I think the fact that they actually have bedded in relatively well over the last few weeks in particular, this kind of, there's definitely, I don't know, maybe trust is overstating it, but there's a growing allegiance between the two and how they operate, shows that perhaps there wasn't a world of difference between the two of them all along. Perhaps it's more than just a one-time coalition agreement to keep Sinn Féin out. Maybe it is a long-term thing. Maybe it would make sense for the parties, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it happen. I don't see it happening anytime soon. I think they really do want to hold on to their own identities. But if in the end it comes down to a question of political survival, then yeah, I think it could happen.
And that is it for the first installment of our Ask Me Anything Christmas special. We're going to be back with part two in a few days' time, so keep an eye on your feed. But until then, thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon. And remember that you can sign up for a subscription to the Irish Times at irishtimes.com/inside. And if you use that particular address, irishtimes.com/inside, they will know that we sent you there, which might help us in our efforts to keep making this podcast just a little bit better into the year to come. So if you're not already a subscriber, we really would be delighted if you consider doing that now. And if you want to get in touch with us, we're always really pleased to hear from you. You just mail us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. So until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.